MechCast, Wednesday, July 8th, 2020. Hey, Mech Geeks, it's time for your MechCast, the show for Mech Geeks by Mech Geeks. I'm Adam, and this is the show where we discuss all things Macintosh. Hey, yeah, I am back. I actually didn't really go anywhere. Well, I guess I kind of did. I went on vacation. Yes, I know Worldwide Developer Conference happened. Of course I do. I know all of the things that went down there, and we're going to be talking about those on this episode of the MechCast. But long-term MechCast listeners likely know that there's a tradition here on the MechCast. Around Worldwide Developer Conference, Apple seems to like to always plan it right around the same time as my yearly family vacation. And I've tried moving my family vacations or adjusting them to different points anywhere between June and July, and without fail, the two seem to overlap. And yeah, I took a little extra time just to relax with everything going on in the world. I kind of needed it, to be honest. Hopefully, you have your ways to kind of relax and get away and things like that. But we took a trip, stayed safe, did all our social distancing and all that stuff, so you don't need to worry about that. We just basically sheltered in place in a different place and had a great time. We head up to the Central Coast every year. Actually saw my friend Michael Johnston up there for a little bit. Again, socially distanced, masked, and all that stuff. So you don't need to email me. We kept it safe. And I'm doing fine. Everything is well. Still here and excited to talk to you about everything that happened at Worldwide Developer Conference. And since you probably know a lot of the major announcements, we'll just go through some of my thoughts and what I'm thinking about in terms of all of the new stuff, things that I'm excited about, things that I'm curious about. The advantage of kind of coming in a little bit later is, of course, that we get more analysis. We get to know a little bit more about what's going on. The reality distortion field wears off a little bit, and we can kind of get down to the nitty-gritty. So we will get into the nitty-gritty stuff. We'll also talk about some other things that have been going on. Rumors, new iPhone 12 stuff. Also other rumors of devices and products that could be coming here in the near future. You probably want to know what new Mac gear, what new Apple gear you might be able to pick up. So we'll get into all of those things. And then we'll get into some discussions. I have some feedback on our in-app purchase subscription discussions. I want to talk about something that went down with Mr. Hanks and talk about that whole situation. We're going to look at a little security thing that kind of popped up because of the latest betas and iOS. There's a new feature in there that kind of surfaced some possibly nefarious things that your apps on iOS have been doing for a little while, and I'm curious to get your opinions and thoughts on that. I've received a lot of questions recently about routers. I have a feeling it's because people are maybe at home more and using their home Wi-Fi a little bit more, and a lot of us probably have aging routers and those sorts of things. So talk about router replacements and options and how to get coverage in your house. Got a question about radio stations and the Mac, and then also a question about backup, one of my favorite topics, as you know, here on the MacCast. So lots of great things to get into and discuss. We'll just jump right in. Of course, the first thing we're going to talk about is all that stuff that went down at Worldwide Developer Conference, the new stuff from Apple, the new stuff that is coming. We'll kick things off with iOS 14 and the new features in there. A lot of new UI, little nice enhancements, updates to apps and stuff like that. Widgets is the big thing. We're going to have widgets now on our home screen. What do you think about that? I'm a little bit excited about it. It is a big change. I'm thinking about my home screen and what that's going to look like and how I interact with apps and stuff like that. But I think it's change for the better. What's cool about the widgets is you can kind of get three different sizes, so they take up different portions of your screen, different amounts of the screen, depending upon which one you want to pick. So you can pick and choose. You can mix and match those with your app icons, so you can have widgets and apps, or all widgets, or just apps, or all your different pages. You can even now hide pages of apps if you want. So if you just have those apps, like I have all the Apple ones that I don't use a whole bunch, and I sort of relegate those to their own little folder. Now I can actually just hide those on a screen, which I think is a pretty cool idea. Another cool thing about widgets is you can stack widgets, put them one on top of the other, so you can kind of swipe and filter through them. And they even have something called a smart stack, which will actually change. It'll use machine learning right on your device, and it will change based on time, location, what kind of activities you're doing to kind of surface the most relevant widget that you might want at any given moment or time. Be curious to see how that works. I like the idea of not having to manage that stuff. And of course, you can always then just flip through those stacks. So that's a pretty cool thing. It's going to be nice to have instant information right when you wake up your home screen. So that does then bring up the question, though, what about your apps, right? To date, our launchers, our home screens have been very app-focused. I mean, only app-focused, really. I guess you've got the, you know, press and hold to kind of do some quick actions and those sorts of things. But really, it was an app launcher. And so now what's going on with apps is they're also going to have something called an app library. It's a whole separate screen that just automatically organizes your apps by category. They also have your recent apps, things that you've recently installed, and all your favorite apps or most frequently used apps right there up at the top. So it has suggestions, the recently added, and all of that stuff will be in this little app library. You can browse through the app library, you can scroll down, you can search the app library to find apps. And I think that's going to be a really good way to access apps, especially given the fact that now probably a good portion of our home screens are going to be eaten up with widgets. And so there's not as much room for those apps anymore. So it's kind of having them all in one place, kind of an app launcher, is, I think, a good idea. Another cool thing that Apple showed off is something called App Clips. And I like this idea because how many times you have those apps that you've installed once? You know, it's like a one-time use app. You're at a restaurant that you don't maybe frequent that often, and you want to pay through their app, so you download the app and you just do your payment or your ordering. Or maybe you rent a scooter, or you're in a remote place and you need some sort of specialized app to access some function or feature or game, or maybe a promotional thing in the grocery store. Right? We have a lot of these kinds of things. I have a bunch of those apps. They end up on your phone. You got to download them from the App Store. It's a big hassle. So Apple's come up with this idea called App Clips. And what it is really tiny little parts of apps that developers can put together that you can download quickly and then just simply kind of discard when you're done using them. So think about maybe going to a city and renting one of those little scooters for riding around. Maybe you don't want to download the full app. You just want to get the app there so you can actually put some time on it, rent the scooter, and then you do have the option with the App Clips to then ultimately install the full app, but it'll just take a couple seconds. You can use the features you want, maybe a parking app, those sorts of things. These are kind of things that Apple showed off, and use it. Right? And I think that's a really great idea. They also showed the fact that you can trigger installing the apps with like an NFC tag. So you can just get your phone near the scooter and it'll pop up and say, hey, do you want to install the little app clip and rent this scooter right now? Make it super easy. And Apple is going to even have their own version of a QR code called an app clip code that'll actually be able to trigger these things. And what's cool is you can also download the little apps from a website. You can share them through social media and links. So I think these are going to be really, really handy. And it'll reduce, I think, the clutter on our phones with all these little one-off apps that sometimes end up on there. So I really do like that idea. Another idea that they showed off that I really like is phone calls not taking over the entire screen. So we can get an incoming phone call either from the phone app, or this will even work with third-party audio apps like Skype and those sorts of things. It'll just pop up in a little notification that you can kind of interact with or swipe away. So it's not going to interrupt what you're doing, right? How many times have you been playing like your favorite game? Someone calls you and boom, you're suddenly in this giant call interface. And they're going to do the same thing with Siri as well. They've got a nice new little Siri interface that doesn't take up the whole screen, including when you ask Siri questions and get feedback. Siri's actually going to have expanded knowledge. She's going to be able to get more answers from the internet, something we've been wanting for a really, really long time. I'm excited about that. And it won't take up the whole screen. So you can ask a question, keep kind of multitasking and doing what you're doing. And I think that's going to be very handy. And Siri also is going to allow you to do on-device dictation, to send audio texts, And that sort of thing. So you can send audio text with Siri. You can do your dictation now right on the device. It doesn't have to go out to the cloud. And that will make dictation even more useful. One of my favorite features on iOS, because, you know, sometimes typing on that little keyboard, not always the best, at least for me. My daughter, she can type like crazy. Her thumbs go flying. I've never gotten that skill down. And I've turned to dictation quite frequently to just talk things out. Of course, being a podcaster is probably something that comes very naturally to me. But all of this, you know, sort of changes with the UI and how we're getting widgets and more functionality. Really got me thinking, and I realized, you know, looking at this release of iOS 14, we're moving to a version of the operating system that is really deprioritizing app icons and launching on the home screen in favor of surfacing information. It's more about that sort of getting information at a glance, getting those things that you care about. I know Apple is a little bit late to this party. A lot of people pointing out that a lot of other devices have had widgets and this kind of functionality for a while now. But as far as Apple goes, the timing on this feels right. It feels like the right evolution of the operating system, and they're doing it in a really smart way. They've learned from, I think, what a lot of others have done and sort of the struggles they've had. It's not been perfect on those other devices, and this looks like a really nice implementation for to me. So, you know, I have a ton of apps, but the reality is I don't know where they are. I have everything organized in folders. I don't know what you do with your organization, but I have things in folders. I kind of know where they are. They're broken into little categories, but at the end of the day, I don't really care all that much. I usually just swipe down, type the name of the app, and just use, you know, the search tool as a app launcher. And so the idea of just having all the apps in one place and letting me then surface more information on my device, that's really appealing to me. You know, tons of wasted space on my home screen for apps that I really don't care about. So push those off to the side. I think this is great. And being able to glance at information and also have that surface with artificial intelligence, things that I really care about, that gets us one step closer to this concept of a knowledge navigator in my pocket. And those of you who have been around in the Apple community for long enough, back in the Apple two days, know what I'm talking about, right? That knowledge navigator video, really cool thing. If you don't know what it is, look it up on YouTube. You'll be blown away. Apple's been thinking about this stuff for a really long time. Let's just say that. Getting back to iOS 14, speaking of knowledge and being able to exchange information in a global community, Apple did say they're going to have a new Translate app doing translations. All of the translations, because of Apple's focus on privacy, are happening locally through the Neural Engine, and that means the translation features will work even without an internet connection, not sending the data to Apple. And initially, they're going to have 11 different languages that you can translate between, and you'll be able to use that functionality also inside Safari for web pages and stuff like that. So if you end up on a web page, you can get translations. It'll be interesting to see how accurate they are. Google's been at this for a really long time. They're pretty decent, but as you know, anybody's ever used it, it's never quite that perfect. So we'll have to see if Apple has done a little bit better. You got picture-in-picture on the iPhone and in iOS now, so you can kind of multitask with your videos, things like that. We've kind of had this, so I'm curious to see how this is a little bit different. I guess maybe it's implemented in more places. Of course, security. Apple is focused on security. They're giving us some new privacy features. There's going to be a new indicator in the status bar that will show you whether the video camera is on and being used, or whether your mic is on and being used to record. You'll get a little orange dot or a green dot, orange for the mic and green for the video, depending. And this is coming about because we have had some instances in the past where it was discovered some apps were kind of recording in the background, or at least had turned on features in the background without you really knowing it. So this will be a good little indicator to make sure that you know what's going on with your device. Of course, one of the big feature apps on iOS is Messages. A lot of us use Messages for a lot of reasons, day in and day out, and Messages is getting some very nice enhancements, some things that I think we've been wanting to see for a really long time, including pinned conversations, so you can take your favorite or most frequented messages and message conversations and pin those right to the top. You can even add little custom icons have your conversations right there. One that I've been really excited, or I've been really wanting to see for a while is threaded inline replies. How many times have you been in a group conversation or even just a conversation one-on-one where, you know, you're going back and forth and somebody responds to something that was like 4 or 5 lines up or maybe even further back, and you kind of lose that context, right? It gets a little bit confusing. So to be able to reply in line right there is going to be really, really nice. And thank goodness we are getting emoji search. So when you bring up that emoji panel, you can actually now search to find the one. They keep adding all these emojis, and I know that I have a really hard time finding them. Apple tried to do that sort of hybrid thing where you could type a word and then when you brought up the emoji keyboard, it would kind of appear in orange and then you could pick it. So it kind of was a reverse weird kind of search. I think just straight up search through the emojis is going to be much handier. Another thing in messaging that's actually coming back, well, it's actually in FaceTime, is the eye contact feature that was part of, I think, the iOS 13 beta. It never quite worked right, so I think they took it out. It sounds like they've got it working now in iOS 14. This is a little feature that when you have FaceTime and you're kind of not quite looking away, it actually will make it appear like you're still focused and looking at the camera. I know it sounds really weird. I think it might look really weird, but you know, when they were showing this off in iOS 13, it didn't. It actually looked pretty natural. So you could be looking down at your phone, not directly at the camera, but the person on the other end is going to see you looking directly at the camera. Again, amazing technology, you know, like facial mapping and all that stuff. I think it uses the sensors in the phone to do that whole facial map and kind of figure out where your eyes and your eyeballs should be, and then does some, you know, power tools or some goo things to like make your eyeballs look up at the camera. Yeah, like I said, it sounds weird, but I'll be interested to see if it works. Supposedly it does. Maps is also getting some nice updates and enhancements, including cycling directions. So if you're a bicyclist, they're going to give you routing information. It'll even tell you like where stairs are on your path and when you're going to have to get off your bike and maybe walk. And you can reroute around and do those sorts of things. A lot of people getting electric vehicles these days, so they're going to do EV routing. That'll help direct you on routes where you can make sure that you have charging stations along the way at points, and it's going to be integrated with your car and your car apps and information, so it'll know sort of your mileage and how far you can go to give you kind of the best routes. There's going to be new guides for certain cities, kind of giving you points of interest that you can interact with. And when you're doing driving directions, apparently it's now going to give you speed and red light camera warnings. So that will be a nice handy feature as well. Photos, not a lot new. I haven't heard a lot new about photos, although I did read that you're going to be able to now add captions to your photos, basically the descriptions that you can put in on the Mac. You'll be able to now do that on iOS. So maybe a little bit better organization for your, or more information, metadata information for your photos. Some new enhancements for AirPods. You're going to now have seamless AirPod switching between your devices. Yep, no more having to go up and toggle that manually. It's supposed to just switch automatically. I'm assuming that'll somehow trigger based on proximity and maybe interaction with an audio app. So if you hit audio, it'll detect, oh, you just triggered it on your Mac. I don't know how it works, but I'm just guessing. Looking forward to that. And if you're an AirPods Pro owner, they showed off really cool spatial audio. So you'll be able to get spatial audio with your AirPods Pro. And they built in head tracking to do this, because obviously, if you're moving your head in space, that spatial audio has to track with your head. And they showed this on stage, and it's just like the things that Apple's engineers think of when they're putting this stuff together just blows my mind. And this is just another example of it. So I'm super excited to try that with my AirPods. I do watch a lot of movies with my AirPods. And so that I assume is going to really enhance the experience. So I'm kind of excited about that one. Find My app is getting third-party support. Apple is going to have a new framework for developers called the Nearby Integration Framework. That'll allow them to take their devices and put it into the Find My app, so you're going to be able to find more things than just your Apple devices. They didn't talk about the thing we'd been hearing about, which is Apple Tags. I'm assuming those are still coming at some point, but that wasn't one of the announcements they made at Worldwide Developer Conference. One that we had been hearing about that they did talk about was digital digital car keys. It's going to be a bit expensive to get digital car keys right off the bat because it's only coming to BMW first. They actually, I think, have some of it out right now, but Apple is working with other car vendors to bring digital car keys. As we thought, it's going to work with the NFC in your phone, so you need to have an NFC-capable car, and your keys will be managed in the wallet app, and you can share keys and set kind of key settings for, you know, the kinds of controls people can have. You know, can they just open the trunk or the car doors, or can they actually start and drive the car, and those sorts of things. So that's going to be very handy. One more thing to go into the wallet app. But again, it's going to take a while, I think, for cars to get the support. BMW owners, so like I said, you're going to be the first ones. So if anybody does have that yet or is going to be getting it soon, I'd love to hear about how it works, what you think about it. Give us some feedback on the show. Send me an audio comment, would be great, to maccast@gmail.com. Here's another kind of big announcement. It was buried. It wasn't actually in, I don't think it was in the keynote. I have to go back and look now. Now I'm second guessing myself, but I don't think it was. You are now in iOS going to have the ability to change your default browser and email client. Yep, that means you're not going to be locked into just Safari and Mail anymore. I'm happy about this because my main mail client on iOS is Spark. And so the ability to have that automatically open when I click on email links rather than going into the Mail app and then having to like copy everything over, you know what a hassle it is. Not going to have to do that anymore. So I don't know what took Apple so long on that one, but I'm happy they did it. They also announced APFS support, so Apple File System support for external drives in the Files app. We've had the ability since iOS 13 to be able to connect external drives and access those like USB sticks and those sorts of things, or even external USB drives from the Files app, but that was limited to just HFS Plus drives. Now you'll be able to also access Apple File System drives. So that's good news. And then there were some cool new accessibility features. And this is the kind of thing where, you know, we say accessibility features, and they are. These are features to help people with their accessibility. But man, often these features, they are cool for everyone. And I like that about these features. One is called BackTap, which allows your device to actually detect when you tap on the back of it to trigger actions. So, you know, you could trigger going to the home screen or activating Siri with a double tap or a triple tap on the back of your device. So that'll be fun to play around with. And they also added sound recognition. So your phone can actually listen for certain sounds like sirens or a doorbell ringing or dogs barking, babies crying, and then alert the user for different kinds of sounds that are detected. Now, Apple's careful to say, you know, don't use this for critical or emergency things, but it could be very handy, especially for someone who has limited hearing. But I can also imagine in situations where, especially if you could tie this into, say, shortcuts in a way, maybe there's ways to trigger events or actions to happen when certain sounds happen. So you could just have your device off in another room or in a place listening for certain events through audio and have things trigger. I don't know if that's something that's possible, but just something that I thought about, it would be really cool if it was. And I imagine Apple could enable that sort of thing. So we'll have to see how that works out. But sound recognition, BackTap, cool new accessibility features in iOS 14. And that's kind of the bulk of it. iOS 14 is out for developers right now, and there are going to be public betas coming sometime in July, Apple says. So it could be any day now, maybe later in the month, I would imagine. As always with beta stuff, be careful. I wouldn't put it on a primary device right off the bat. Public beta may be a little bit safer, but you know, be careful out there. Make sure you have your backups, all that good stuff. As far as what devices iOS 14 will support, it's going to support the iPhone SE, iPhone 6S and newer, and the iPod Touch 7th generation. So if you have any of those devices, you will be able to run iOS 14, and that's going back pretty far. You know, Apple's done a pretty good job, I think, of keeping things backwards compatible. So we're going to get into some of the other operating systems. A lot of the stuff is going to cross over, so we won't have to go as deep as we did here with iOS 14. iPadOS has all those widgets that you're going to get in iOS 14. Of course, it has some new user interface enhancements. Photos and music are going to get sidebar. The big kind of announcement, though, I think, is something called Scribble. Now, Apple has had Scribble on the Mac and in various forms. You know, you got Scribble basically on your Apple Watch. What it is going to do on iPadOS is give you the ability to take your Apple Pencil and hand write text that you can then interact with and manipulate anywhere in the operating system. So you'll be able to manipulate written text just like plain text. You can copy and paste it. When you paste it, it can paste as handwritten, as handwritten text or as text. So you can actually do handwriting to text recognition. You can also have data detectors that work with handwritten text. So if you handwrite a phone number, you can tap on that and have it make that phone call. Or if you hand write a date, it could prompt you to say, hey, do you want to add that to your schedule or to your calendar? Same thing for addresses. Open that up in the Maps app. It's going to have shape recognition. So if you draw a shape and you get close to the shape, it will kind of make it nice for you, right? It'll clean it up, create a square out of a little scribbly square or triangle, something like that. So a lot of cool features in there. And you'll also have the ability, like even in your browser, to handwrite right into text fields. So rather than typing into a text field, you can write into that text field and it'll convert it to text and fill that out for you. So it'll be an interesting way to fill out forms online, I think. It'll be curious to see how well it works. I would imagine it works pretty well. You know, again, between the Newton and all the other technologies, Apple has had a lot of time to work on this. And I'm also curious to see how it works, again, in a web field, because obviously you're going to maybe start writing in that field, which I think it will detect, and it's going to be hard to stay in a little tiny field. So it looked like when they demoed it, you start writing in the field, but then you just kind of write across your display, and it will actually recognize all of that and then just convert it to text and paste it right into that text field. So that looks like a cool new feature. They're going to have the same call and Siri UI interface enhancements as they do on iOS 14. And the iPadOS is going to support all iPad Pros, the 5th gen and newer iPads, iPad Air 2 and newer, and iPad Mini 4 and newer. So again, going pretty far back in terms of devices, which is really nice to see. Some of the new enhancements to watchOS. Big thing is they're going to be renaming the activity app Fitness. Also, another big thing is, and something we were expecting, is built-in sleep tracking with iPhone integration. So they're going to have this wind down mode, kind of a setup screen that then you can set up, hey, this is when I want to get ready for bed, try to get you on a little bit more of a schedule. It'll start to wind you down by turning on Do Not Disturb. It can suggest activities like meditation or suggest some quiet music that you might want to listen to. If your battery is running low, it's going to prompt you within an hour of your bedtime to say, hey, let's get your watch on the charger so that it's all ready for when you go to sleep to track your sleeping. So it'll remind you and get you all set up for bedtime. And then it puts you through a bedtime routine. You can even have HomeKit integration, so you can have that bedtime routine, you know, dim the lights and set up a mood and, you know, probably play music and do all sorts of cool things. As far as waking up, you have options for quiet alarms, for a haptic wake up, or even getting a friendly greeting in the morning, I would assume from Siri. Sleep data is encrypted on your device, so again, it's kept secure, or you can sync it up to iCloud, again, encrypted on iCloud with iCloud Sync, then sync it across to your devices. So that's the new sleep tracking feature in WatchOS. You're also going to get some new workout types, including dance, core training, functional strength training, and cool down. And as mentioned, Apple Maps, those cycling routes in select cities will also be available and supported on the Apple Watch. Another thing we're getting is some more functionality for Apple Watch faces. You're going to be actually able to do face sharing. There's going to be a new face called the Chronograph Pro with tachymeter, and customized watch faces will be able to be downloaded. Those, you know, shared faces, you can actually download them from websites. You can get them through messaging apps and messaging, or they can be even shared on social media. So I have a feeling you're going to see a lot more sites offering up different watch faces. Another thing that I'm kind of excited about, because I do use some third-party apps like Carrot Weather that offer complications. In the past with Apple Watch, you could only have from a single app a single complication location. So even if your watch face offered multiple locations, I could only have the Carrot app in one of those slots. But the Carrot app actually has a couple different bits of information that you can display. So now you will actually be able to put a complication from the same third-party app in multiple places within the watch interface. So you could have one app or one watch face that's just complications from a single app entirely on that watch face. And so that's going to be super handy. I don't think this was pure timing on Apple's part, but there is hand washing detection now. They're going to be able to detect when you're washing your hands and set up a countdown timer so you make sure that you wash your hands for at least 20 seconds. It was kind of cute. It had this little kind of liquid number countdown interface to it. I don't know how useful it's going to be for myself, but hey, it's in there. And like I said, timing is everything, right? We need to make sure we're washing our hands and staying safe. Another cool thing that I think is coming about because of not just the Noise app, but Apple has also been doing their hearing research study. Your Apple Watch is going to be able to warn you about loud music and sound exposure. So sound exposure to sounds of louder than 80 dB for more than 40 hours a week. Anything beyond that is bad for your hearing or potentially bad for your hearing, and your Apple Watch will be able to warn you about that based on sound data that it's been capturing. So tell you, hey, be careful. You want to probably keep things at a little bit lower volume for the rest of the week and kind of keep you under that threshold. Something that wasn't talked about during the announcement, but I think is kind of important and indicator of Apple moving away from the feature, is Watch OS 7 will be dropping Force Touch support. So even if your phone or your Apple Watch, excuse me, has Force Touch, that is not going to be built into the operating system anymore. Apple's going to, you know, redo the interfaces to, I would assume, do the same thing they've done on iOS, which is a tap and hold or other kinds of ways to access the same functionality, but you're not going to be able to force press on the Apple Watch face anymore to activate things with WatchOS 7. So a little bit of a loss there. It was kind of a nice feature. I'd never been a real huge fan because I think it's what I always have called sort of hidden UI. And it's not really surfaced very well, so people don't know about it. I don't know that the whole tap and hold thing does any better in terms of discovery, but, you know, it at least keeps things consistent, right? I think Apple Watch and maybe some older iPhones were the last devices to kind of have Force Touch built into them. So making that change, not surprising. WatchOS 7 will support Apple Watch Series 3 or later. So I'm finally out, folks. I have an Apple Watch Series 2, so I will not be upgrading to WatchOS 7, at least not until I get a new Apple Watch. And I'm not really sure I'm, you know, in the market for a new Apple Watch. It was pretty expensive to get this stainless steel one, and I'm thinking there's a new iPhone 12 in my future, and that's a little bit pricey. So I don't know. Maybe I can get an Apple Watch Series 3, which has come way down in pricing, and maybe upgrade to that or update to that. I guess that's technically an upgrade if I have an Apple Watch Series 2. Seems crazy though, because we're moving on to what, Series 6? I think that's what should be coming out in the fall when Apple makes its new announcement. So maybe they'll tempt me with an Apple Watch Series 6. We'll have to see. tvOS, a couple new enhancements there. The Home app is getting integration with something called Home View. It'll be accessed via the Control Center and give you access to alerts from your HomeKit video cameras. You'll also be able to control scenes inside HomeKit from the HomeView app on your Apple TV, so you can set up your scenes for watching movies, all those sorts of things. Something I'm excited about, because with Apple Arcade, we're playing a lot more games on our Apple TV. It's great with a controller. And they're finally adding multiple user support for games. We've had multi-user support on tvOS, but it was curiously not part of Game Center. So even though you switch your account, you'd still have to go back in and manually change the user inside Game Center. It was a giant pain in the butt. That's changing. So when you change your user, you'll be able to change your Game Center and your games. That means you can start on one device and then move on to the Apple TV and vice versa. And it's going to make it a lot more convenient. So I'm excited about that. Also, expanded controller support. Like I said, Apple TV games are great with a controller. So more Xbox controller support. They're also adding audio sharing to the Apple TV. So if you have multiple people in your house with AirPods, you can all be listening through your AirPods together through the Apple TV. Picture-in-picture support also coming to the updated tvOS. And something that they didn't show off, but I read about, was a new enhancement to the screensavers. You'll now be able to select the type of screensaver that you'd like to see. So they have different categories like landscape, earth, underwater, and cityscapes, and you'll be able to pick, and then your Apple TV will just show screensavers from that category. I kind of like the mix and match, so I hope that continues to be an option. I'd probably just leave it there. Apple has those great, beautiful screensavers for tvOS or for Apple TV, and I think they're awesome. And then if you're a YouTube fan, Apple TV is finally getting 4K support for YouTube. Some new stuff coming to the HomePod and HomePod OS as well. Support for changing your default services for music, podcasts, and audiobooks. Yeah, third-party apps like Spotify and third-party podcast apps are going to be able to be supported on HomePod OS. Of course, they're going to have to bring the apps to the service first, but once they're there, you can pick a different player. So you don't just have to be stuck with Apple's options on your HomePod. So that'll be really nice. And not only that, you'll be able to set up those settings per user. So HomePods have the ability to detect via voice multiple users, and each user can have their own favorite music service or app or podcast service or app on the HomePod. And then one little bit of HomeKit integration that's pretty interesting. If you have a HomeKit-supported doorbell, you can get doorbell announcements from your HomePod. So your HomePod will let you know, hey, someone's at the door, and then you can use your Apple TV to bring up the video and see who's there. So pretty cool integration with HomeKit and the HomePod update. And then the kind of big announcement for macOS, wait for it, Big Sur. I think that had kind of come out in the rumors. Really cool place if you've never been there. But macOS Big Sur is going to be the next version of macOS. And guess what? It goes to 11, folks. Yep, finally, version 11. If you look at About This Mac and you're running macOS Big Sur, it is 11.0, baby. Yeah, finally. It's taken them long enough, right? And it makes sense. We were headed there, and we finally got there. And I think they're doing it for multiple reasons, but probably the biggest one is an updated user interface. The biggest kind of update to the UI that we've seen in a while now. They're going to use a lot more transparency and translucency, a lot of kind of lighting effects, subtle shading and shadowing. Some people have said it looks more in line with iOS and iPadOS, so it's kind of bringing the two operating systems closer together. We still have separate operating systems, don't worry. It's going to be that way for a while, although I do think this Worldwide Developer Conference kind of shows how things are getting closer and closer. We're going to reach a convergence at some point. I think it's inevitable, right? We can see the things happening, and this UI update in macOS Big Sur is definitely one of those indicators. What they're calling this sort of style is new morphism. So you remember we had skeuomorphism, which was like all that realistic interface like GarageBand, and you know, the thing kind of looks like the real world thing, knobs and buttons and those things. And then there was like a big pushback. It's like we're going to material and flat designs and all those sorts of things. Now we're kind of moving back in the other direction. So you've got subtle light and shadow. Things aren't the actual representations of the things, but you've got things that look more like buttons. They're kind of button-like, and things sort of extrude up from the material, and you kind of have a little bit of an embossed look. But like I said, it's a lot of playing with light and transparency and translucency, and I think it looks beautiful. It's very subtle and nice, and I think I'm really going to enjoy the new look and style. Some people have kind of pushed back because some of the icons have a little bit more realistic look. You've got that shadowing and kind of drop shadow sort of thing happening. So it is definitely a change from the flat design if you're totally into that. But I'm looking forward to a nice little refresh. It doesn't seem too extreme, feels nice and subtle, and I think it looks ultimately pretty darn good. Great big news, the Mac startup chime is back. Yes, it went away because we had some Macs that would automatically start up when you just opened the lid or touched a key. It's coming back now. I'm not really sure how it works with those Macs, but no hacking required. You remember there was a way to kind of enable it, get it back turned on in the current Mac operating system. You're not going to have to do that. And it can be controlled in the system preferences, so you can choose to have it on or off. So Apple giving us the choice. I think most of us Mac faithful are probably going to opt for this startup chime, right? There's just something reassuring about that bong that we're so used to and it's been around for such a long time. It's the very beginning, right? It's the sound of the Mac. And when it went away, it was a pretty sad day. Another feature that's coming over from iOS, making its way to the Mac, is the Control Center. So you'll be able to, you know, click an icon in the toolbar and access things like Bluetooth and volume and brightness controls, a lot of the same things that you see on iOS. And don't worry if you're the type of person that wants all those controls in the toolbar, because I was wondering about this myself. You know, was the Control Center going to actually replace things like the volume button or the Bluetooth button in the toolbar? Nope, it's not. You can actually drag elements out from the Control Center directly into the menu bar so you can get them back in there. And I would assume the inverse is true, that you can drag items from the menu bar right into the Control Center and access them that way. Also, an updated Notification Center. It's a lot more floaty, and it does support the new widgets. Widgets and notifications are actually combined now, so you don't have that sort of two different tabs to access those things. It'll all be right there in the one interface, and then you can just scroll up and down through it. It will support the iOS 14 widget system, so you have the different sized widgets and you can kind of lay them out as you want and get the information that you want and surfaced through those widgets. So that looks really nice and clean. I like that styling. And then, of course, we've got a bunch of updated apps, messages. It's going to have all those features. It's actually a Catalyst app now, so a lot of the features that you see in iOS are coming right over to the Mac because it's essentially the same app. So they have an inline photo picker, Memoji support, the pinned messages, message threading, all that good stuff. Same thing for maps, Catalyst app, all the iOS 14 map features, favorites, collections are going to finally be on the Mac. So we're getting a lot more parity in our applications because of this convergence of the operating systems. Still a very Mac-like operating system, though. This is not iOS on the Mac. It is a Macified version of iOS, maybe? Is that the way to put it? It's macOS Big Sur. It's its own thing. We shouldn't relegate it to being anything less, because it looks beautiful. It looks amazing. I'm super excited about it. Safari is getting some nice new features, including intelligent tracking prevention in the form of a privacy report. So it's going to be able to tell you when you go into websites what kind of trackers they're using, what kind of third-party cross-site tracking they're doing, and you can make options, better options, and more informed options about controlling your security and privacy on the web. They're also bringing extensions to Safari in a bigger way. Of course, we've had Safari extensions in the past, but they're going to now support the Web Extensions API. They've been part of that working group, and so expect a lot more from extensions, including there's going to be like an extensions app store. And I'm looking forward to that because, especially as a web developer, there's a lot of extensions and tools that are really helpful and useful, but a lot of them are only available on Chrome. And, you know, Chrome, not the best browser, I have to tell you, for security and privacy, as you might imagine. So I have to use it for development, have been using it for development. I kind of bounce back and forth, but the idea of having more extensions and availability in Safari, that's appealing to me. A customizable start page is also very appealing. You can even customize backgrounds and change what kind of information is on your start screen. Like I said, it feels like a lot of the enhancements between widgets and things like the Safari start page is a lot about surfacing information and getting more to that place where daily, you know, we use and interact with these devices and our computers so frequently to surface and sort of bring up information that might be relevant or important to us in really smart and useful ways, I think is a great thing. You know, Safari's getting the translation feature, so you'll be able to use that new translation stuff inside Safari. And again, all about getting more access to information globally and more easily. And I think that's really pretty cool. APFS support is coming to Time Machine backups, so Time Machine can now be done with an APFS formatted volume, and that's kind of the big highlights with macOS Big Sur. I'm sure there's a lot more to come. Oh, compatibility. If you're wondering if you can update and run macOS Big Sur, 2015 and later MacBooks, 2013 and later MacBook Air, 2013 and later MacBook Pro, 2014 and later Mac Minis, 2014 and later iMacs, 2017 and later iMac Pros, and the 2013 or later Mac Pro. So again, Apple going all the way back as far as, you know, 7-8 years with support for macOS Big Sur. And I can't think of any other computer company that has that much backwards compatibility. So that is pretty, pretty cool. So that was all of the announcements surrounding the new operating systems. Of course, there is that one more big, big thing. As we were expecting, Apple is doing another processor transition. If you've been around in the Mac community for long enough, you know we've been through a couple of these, right? We had from the Motorola to the IBM PowerPC way, way back in the day. Then we had from PowerPC to Intel. Now we're going from Intel to Apple-designed silicon. So Apple is moving to ARM-based Macs, and they are doing it quick, folks. This is an aggressive schedule. It's pretty impressive. Why are they doing it? I talked about that on the last MacCast. It's all about speed and efficiency. Apple has an amazing engineering team. They've proven themselves time and time again with the processors that we have in our iPads and our iPhones. These things are blazing. They have the efficiencies. We've been talking about this coming for a while. The day is here. Apple announced it at Worldwide Developer Conference, and I am, as you might be able to tell, excited about it. Even though I just recently bought a brand new Mac that's going to be running and great for a long time. Apple's not getting rid of Intel support. It's going to be around for a while. A lot of the announcements that they made prove their dedication. You know, even though they're going to do the transition internally to in the hardware pretty quickly, they know that Intel-based Macs are going to be around for a long time. Let's face it, Apple makes great machines. We use these things for 5, 6, 7, 8 years. So they're not going to abandon us anytime soon. I would imagine after about 5 years from the time they transition fully to ARM-based Macs is probably when the cutoff's going to be. So just fair warning on that. But that's pretty decent. I think that's kind of what they did when we transitioned to Intel. So we'll all be moving sooner or later. Apple didn't say which Macs they're actually going to be releasing as ARM-based Macs, but they did say they would have one by the end of the year. Now, Ming-Chi Kuo said he thinks it's going to be a 13-inch MacBook Pro and a 24-inch iMac. He's pretty reliable, so he's got some indicators out there. We've been hearing some rumors about some other models. Apple did say they do have more Intel Macs in the pipeline. So again, they're probably going to be supporting it for a few years. As far as when the full transition will be done, Apple says 2 years. So that means 2 years from the time of this announcement, you're not going to be able to buy an Intel-based Mac as a new Mac. Of course, they'll be around, but Apple will have fully transitioned to their own processors. And that brings a lot of kind of cool things that Apple talked about, including the ability to run iPhone and iPad apps natively on the Mac. So developers will be able to just take their apps and have them run on the Mac. So the App Store is going to get a ton more apps. Now, the user experience, you know, that's going to be interesting. I'm curious to see how that works. You know, we have Catalyst that lets you take today, that lets you take an iOS app and adapt it and tweak it to be a Mac app. That's different than just, you know, plopping an iPhone app on your Mac, which doesn't have a touchscreen and has a completely different user interface, right? Of course, we have trackpads and you can kind of simulate that stuff, but not so sure that's going to be the greatest experience, but again, convergence, right? Here's another indication that iOS, macOS are really on this convergence course. They're going to crash into each other. You're going to get your chocolate and your peanut butter, and hopefully it's going to taste great, right? Just like a Reese's. And I think it is. I think Apple's making the right steps to make that happen. And some of those steps include, you know, all the things that we need to do to support a transition. And we've been through it before, and Apple's giving us the same tools now to make the transition. So Universal 2, for those of you who remember Universal, this is a way for developers to take their code, take their app, and build it for both Intel processors and ARM-based Macs natively. So you'll have a single app that can run natively on both platforms, keeping the speed and performance and all those sorts of things. Hopefully developers don't have to do a lot of extra work. They probably have to do some extra work, but it should be, for most apps, I think, pretty straightforward. And Apple showed a number of apps already running on ARM-based Macs, including all of the big ones like Microsoft Office, Adobe Photoshop. Those were demoed as native ARM apps. I would assume those were actually universal binaries. And Apple also said that they have Final Cut running on ARM as well. So I think with the announcements and the timing, developers are going to have plenty of time to get their apps together. But even if they don't, when new ARM-based Macs come out, Apple is also going to have Rosetta coming back. So Rosetta 2, and if you remember, Rosetta was the thing that would allow you to basically take a PowerPC app and through emulation run it on your Intel Mac. Same thing they're going to do here for Intel apps now running on ARM-based Macs. You will be able to take that app and just run it inside Rosetta 2 or with the emulation. It'll take a little bit of a speed hit, but hopefully not too bad if the performance on the processors is really good, and we expect that from Apple. So should be okay. A couple of things that aren't going to work, though, that people would want to know about. Kernel extensions are not going to be able to run in Rosetta 2. And more importantly, and this is kind of a big hit for some people, although I'm sure there will be some solutions for this, virtualized machines that virtualize x86 64-bit computers, So the ability to run Parallels in Windows on an ARM-based Mac, that's a little bit up in the air. We don't know what's going on there right out of the box. Rosetta is not going to support that, though. So you're not going to be able to take your Parallels that you have today and run that on your ARM-based Mac. There's going to have to be some other solution. I would imagine there's going to be virtualization solutions made to run Windows on an ARM-based Mac. It's going to probably be pretty tricky to do, but you know, there's a lot of smart people out there. I think they're going to be able to pull it off. We're just going to have to wait and see what goes on with that. As a matter of fact, all of the apps that Apple has in Big Sur have been built, they said, as ARM binaries. So all of their apps are ready to go as well. And they're not leaving developers out in the lurch. Of course, they announced developer transition kits. And this was pretty interesting, right? Because we were wondering, what is the first ARM-based Mac going to be? Well, it's actually the developer transition kit, and it's a modded Mac Mini. So they're giving developers a Mac Mini with an Apple A12Z processor. That's the same processor that's in the new iPad Pros, with 16 gigabytes of RAM and a 512 gigabyte SSD. And that's their new development platform, for them so they can get their software and everything ready for the ARM-based transition. And they told developers, hey, don't benchmark these things, you know, don't put those numbers out there, please. Of course, they didn't listen. We've got numbers on performance, and a lot of people are wondering about performance. The problem is that none of the tools are really written for benchmarking ARM-based Macs, because they didn't exist. So people are running tools. They're running Geekbench, which is really built for Intel, on these ARM-based Macs. And we saw single core scores on the developer transition kit Macs of 800 and multi-core scores of 2700. Basically, MacBook Air performance. And you might be going, Adam, that doesn't sound all that great, right? I thought we were supposed to get great Apple processors that are super, super fast. And you would be right. Again, these tools aren't designed for this. They're running in Rosetta 2 under emulation. So take all the numbers with a grain of salt. You know, Apple, when these things finally release, I mean, think about how powerful the iPhone processors are, the iPad processors. You know, Android can't catch up. They're not even hardly in the race when you compare them. If you go out and look at performance benchmarks, Apple, you know, with the number of cores they put in there, the integration of the hardware and software, you're talking about system on a chip. So you've got your GPU and your CPU. You know, there's not a lot of overhead in terms of the bandwidth going between those things. They're screaming fast. And so Apple is going to, and they've got some of the best. I mean, they've hired, we've talked about this on the show, the kinds of engineering talent that they've hired over the years in terms of designing CPUs and GPUs and processors and stuff like that. It's through the roof. So it's going to be really fun to see them take this to the desktop. Take everything that they've learned in building processors for mobile, things that are extremely energy efficient, run quickly, very performance driven, but do it with lower power, lower heat. It's going to enable Apple to do really amazing new designs with their systems and computers, and just take everything to the next level. So I am looking forward to the next wave. Now, again, I'm not going to be in the market for a new computer for probably the next 5 years, so they'll be well into the transition before I'm ready for it. But even, you know, the first systems, I think, are going to blow us away, and I'm super, super excited about it. Is there going to be bumps in the road? I can almost guarantee it, right? There's going to be little hiccups. There's going to be little bumps. Early adopters are going to face some challenges, for sure. But, you know, I think they're going to be minimal. Apple has done a very good job in these transitions in the past, and I don't see any indications at this point that this one is going to be any different. So I am super excited about it. Now, one question that did come up recently was the question of GPUs. You know, are Apple's new systems going to have discrete GPUs? Because if you look at your iOS devices, the GPU is integrated. It's system on a chip. It's all one piece. Integrated CPUs or GPUs, and that's all your devices have. We don't know at this point. You know, they could go with discrete GPUs. Apple's not really commenting on it, but there have been some hints recently that have been sort of dropped at Worldwide Developer Conference and through some documentation. Gizmodo pointed out that there's a developer support document and a session that was done on Metal where Apple talked about their graphics architecture for ARM-based Macs. And in the session, they described their system-on-a-chip GPUs with Metal as using tile-based deferred rendering. And what this does is this captures an entire scene and before it starts to render it, breaks it up. It splits it up into these tiny little multiple regions or tiles, and then those get processed separately. And it then is therefore able to process the information pretty quickly, and in a way that doesn't require a lot of memory bandwidth. And so then what it does is it doesn't render that scene until it goes through and rejects any and all occluded pixels. So basically, I think the way this works is like 3D environment, you're rendering a 3D thing. There's going to be a lot of stuff that normally would get rendered, but it's like covered up. So why would you want to process or render those pixels, right? So you split it up, you analyze it, you look at everything, and you kind of only render and build out the stuff that is actually seen. And this is happening super, super quickly, right? As things are moving around, obviously. But you get the point, is like you're not wasting that. And Intel, NVIDIA, and AMD, they use a different, almost opposite method, something called immediate mode renderer, which renders the entire scene and then decides what to throw out. So you kind of render everything and then you throw things away. A lot less efficient. And so Apple is able, with their method, to offer really great performance and much lower power consumption. And so there's some indications that, you know, maybe Apple's not going to need discrete GPUs. And what they said in their developer support doc was, quote, "Don't assume that discrete GPU means better performance." And so don't be surprised if the first ARM-based Macs hit the market and they don't have dedicated GPUs, but they actually perform better than some of the dedicated GPUs on the market. Is that an absolute certainty? No, not at this point. We might even have discrete GPUs on ARM-based Macs, but it could go either way at this point. And a lot of people are wondering about it. We'll keep our eye on it, and we'll have to see what Apple ultimately does. Another technology that people would be wondering about with ARM-based Macs would be Thunderbolt, because Thunderbolt was built in collaboration with Intel, and Intel does the controllers and the chips for Thunderbolt. So if Apple's abandoning Intel as their CPU, would they have Thunderbolt? Well, Thunderbolt 4 was announced this week, and Apple did confirm that their new ARM-based Macs are going to support it. What's interesting about Thunderbolt 4, it's a little bit confusing. We don't have a lot of information right now. It has the same speed as Thunderbolt 3, uses the same connector, so it's 40 gigabits per second maximum speed. It does have some enhancements, though. It's going to be able to support two 4K displays instead of just one, or one 8K display. It has a little bit higher PCI bandwidth requirement, 32 gigabits per second versus 16 gigabits per second. But it is the same USB-C design in terms of the port, and it will be backward compatible with USB-C and USB 4. So Thunderbolt will make its way to the new ARM-based Macs in the Thunderbolt 4 version. So that was kind of all the announcements from WWDC. I guess the other thing to talk about was they didn't obviously have a live event. And I don't know if you had a chance to see the keynote. I watched it all the way through once and kind of bits and pieces since. It was different, but it was really cool. Very well produced, as you might imagine. And I think they did a great job putting it together. There's been some debate on what we preferred. You know, do we like the live thing, or is this maybe the new format going forward, where they kind of pre-produce something and put it all together? I'd like to see them personally go back to the live event. I think it has a little bit more excitement, a little less bad dad jokes, probably. I guess they still have those, but this one seemed a little bit more riddled with that. But I enjoyed the production value. I kind of liked what they did with it. So it was fun. It was kind of a cool way to see the new Apple campus. They kind of went around to different places and shot things from different points of view. They also had a lot more people involved, although they've been doing that with their live keynotes as well, right? Getting more engineers, more talent, more marketing people, kind of people from across the board at Apple involved in doing the presentations. And I actually like that. I think it shows the diversity. It shows kind of the level of talent, and you get to know a little bit more about the inner workings of Apple, which is always pretty secretive, right? So I thought it was a great keynote. I really enjoyed it. I'd love to know what you thought about all of this. What features are you excited about? What things are you maybe concerned about? Shoot me some feedback. Send me an email, maccast@gmail.com, and I look forward to hearing from you. Again, sorry it took so long to get to all this stuff, but man, what a bunch of great stuff to sit here and talk about. And of course, that's not everything that's happening with Apple this week. We have a few more things to talk about in the news. Let's kick off with some of the latest iPhone 12 stuff. Seems like the iPhone 12 Pros might be getting those higher ProMotion refresh rate displays, OLED displays with 120 hertz refresh rate. This is info from a reliable Samsung leaker, believe it or not, but somebody who probably has some knowledge of what's going on in the supply chain. He says that they're getting displays ready for iPhone 12, and they are 120 hertz. And we've been back and forth on this rumor, so it's pointing back in that direction, I guess. And another thing that's kind of pointing in that direction is accessibility in iOS 14 beta has the ability to limit the refresh rate on the display to 60 hertz. And so I guess the question would be, why would you need to limit a 60 hertz refresh rate display down to 60 hertz, right? The assumption would be there's something going to be higher. And of course, we do have ProMotion displays in iPadOS, but this is in iOS 14, not iPadOS. So indicators that we could be getting a higher refresh rate OLED display with iPhone 12. Cameras on the Pro versions are also possibly going to be able to support shooting 4K video at 120 frames per second and 240 frames per second. So again, better cameras, something we often see on the iPhone updates. And a new 20-watt power adapter has been rumored. We've been seeing indications of that. The disappointing side of that is it's sounding like that adapter not going to be in the box. neither will earpods. Apple trimming out the accessories, and they've done this in the past, right? An iPhone or a model or a device, as it ages, they start to take accessories out and maybe even charge more. I think I read a report that iPhones this year might be $50 more expensive and not come with an adapter, not come with headphones. A lot of people pretty upset about that. I'm indifferent about it. You know, I have AirPods. I have a lot of chargers and cables that I've acquired over the years, but not everybody's in the same boat. And it's kind of a catch-22, right? Because by taking those accessories out, it lets them have a thinner box. It means less of that stuff for people who don't need it going into the landfills. We've seen inserts leaked that seem to show that there's not going to have space in the box. They're not going to have space in the box for those accessories. So you're looking at an iPhone and what I presume would be a USB-C to Lightning cable in the box. And that is it. So those are kind of the latest on the iPhone 12. Of course, all the other stuff still in play, you know, new A14 processor, the different sizes, 5.4, 6.1, and 6.7. I'm going off memory. I don't have this in my show notes. I think that was it. 6.7 inch on the Pro version. I'm sure you'll correct me if I got that one wrong. All happening probably sometime in, I'm going to go out and say October at this point, with maybe even a delayed release. It could happen in September. September, October timeframe, that's when we're expecting Apple to do an event and announce the new iPhones. A few other rumors and odds and ends to get to in this episode. Ming-Chi Kuo says that Apple plans to launch a new 10.8-inch iPad in the second half of 2020, followed by a new 8.5-inch iPad in the first half of 2021. It's still not clear if these are going to be a replacement for the 10.2-inch. This is the 10.8-inch iPad. It's not clear if it's going to be a replacement for the 10.2-inch iPad Air or maybe some sort of hybrid. I would presume the 8.5-inch iPad is the iPad Mini, updated version of that, which we've been hearing about. Also in the rumors, a 12.9-inch iPad Pro with a mini LED display in the first quarter of 2021. This is expected to have an A14X Bionic chip, and the wireless models are expected to gain 5G connectivity. And mini LED displays, those allow us to have brightness, high brightness, and high contrast ratio in a thinner, more energy efficient form factor. So Apple's been playing around and looking at supposedly mini LED displays in a lot of their products. This 12.9-inch iPad Pro might be one of the first ones that we see with that technology. Geekbench scores also showed up this past week for what looks like a new unreleased iMac. According to the scores, it seemed to have an Intel 3.6 gigahertz Core i9-10910 chip with 10 CPU cores. So on the higher end of things, it also showed an unannounced AMD Radeon 5300 GPU. So we'd been hearing, you know, as Ming-Chi Kuo pointed out, that there might be a new 24-inch iMac with an Apple CPU. This one looks more to be maybe one of those new Intel models that Tim Cook said they're still planning on release, and could be an update for the 27-inch iMac. So Apple could be getting ready and set to update the iMac lineup pretty soon. AirPods 3 are also out there and being rumored. Rumors are saying, according to Ming-Chi Kuo, that they will be similar in design to the AirPods Pro. They will have that smaller, compact system in a package solution, and also take on a similar form factor with a smaller case. I would assume, though, likely without the advanced features like noise canceling and spatial audio. That would kind of distinguish them from the AirPods Pro. I don't know if they'll still have the same ear tips. I would assume that they would. And indications are that they could arrive in the first half of 2021. And then finally, we're also hearing rumors about a possible new 14-inch and 16-inch MacBook Pro, again, with mini LED displays, coming sometime in the first quarter of 2021. So, you know, Apple updating the operating system with macOS Big Sur, and looks like they have quite a few Macs in the lineup. What's not clear, obviously, is which ones of those are going to support and have the new ARM processor from Apple, and which ones are going to be Intel. I expect the next year to kind of have a mix of both, trending toward more and more ARM-based Mac releases near the end of the year. So in the fall, I would expect that's when we'll see those updates. These ones that are coming earlier in the year, sometime in the first quarter of 2021, other than one or two models, I would expect all of them to be Intel-based Macs. And, you know, as I indicated earlier, Apple will be supporting both platforms for years to come. So no need to panic at this point. I'm, like I said, super excited about the transition. I think it's going to be great for Apple and the Mac community at large. But again, I'd really like to hear your thoughts and opinions on it. Shoot me some feedback. I look forward to your audio comments at maccast@gmail.com. But with that, that is going to do it for the news for this past couple weeks. Before we move on, I do want to take a quick moment and thank a show sponsor, and that is Linode. Hey, if you're looking to set up a server and you want to do it quickly and easily, head over to Linode. They allow you to instantly deploy and manage an SSD server in their Linode cloud. You can get a server up and running literally in seconds with your choice of Linux distribution, resources, and your choice of 10 different node locations. Best of all, they're giving all new MacCast customers a $20 credit. So you can go over there, take a new Linode out for a spin, and you can do all sorts of things with your Linode. As a server, it gives you all of the options and choices that you want to build the services and features that you need. Whatever your requirements, you can build it on Linode. They can do dedicated CPUs, you can build distributed applications, hosted services, websites, blogs, continuous integration environments, continuous delivery environments, you name it, all on your choice of Linux distribution. And all of the Linodes feature advanced features like SSD storage, a 40 gigabit network, and industry-leading processors. Pricing is super simple, no surprise fees. You pay just for what you use with hourly billing across all of their plans and add-on services. And their cloud manager, it has a great user interface, makes it super easy to manage your Linodes, get everything up and running, and even upgrading your plan is super, super simple. So you can start out with maybe just what you need, and as you grow, your Linode is going to be able to grow with you. Just visit linode.com/maccast to set up your first Linode and get a $20 credit. That's linode.com/maccast, linode.com/maccast, and a big thank you to Linode for their support of the show. Let's talk a little bit about in-app purchases. I was talking about this a while back here on the MacCast, and Jill wrote in with a great point of discussion regarding that Hey app. And this was all a dust-up, right? Because Hey got rejected from the App Store. This is an app from the folks who make Basecamp, because it didn't have in-app purchases for their service, and Apple was requiring it because the app does not work without a subscription to the service. So they were basically saying, hey, your app has no functionality here. We want you to offer in-app purchase and have a subscription. They didn't want to do that because of Apple's 30% cut, and there was that whole back and forth. And Jill wrote in to point out, because I was kind of defending them, you know, I think we're at a point where they can reduce that cut that they're taking. You know, 30% is pretty hefty depending upon what you're doing as an app developer. And yes, Apple provides some great services and some features for that, but it can be cost prohibitive depending upon what you're trying to do. And they've cut deals with kind of some of the bigger players, and maybe not everybody has that kind of clout. And so I kind of felt like it'd be nice just for Apple to level the playing field. And let's face it, it's not like they need the money. You know, I don't want Apple to not be profitable or make money off of it, but I have a feeling they're making a pretty good percentage by taking that 30%. And that's just my opinion. But Jill wrote in kind of with a different point of view, and I thought it was a great point of discussion and something we should talk about. And to her point, she said, hey, they're potentially actually, by not participating in-app purchase, they're cutting out part of their market, and I'm part of that market. It is, you know, the folks who want the convenience of just buying through Apple and right in the app and through their Apple account, and more importantly, the privacy that Apple brings. Because Apple, if you're using their in-app purchasing, they're not sharing all your information. They're not exposing your data, right? You're keeping your credit card information, everything with Apple. And there's a lot of people that trust the relationship with Apple a lot more than they might with other third-party developers. And that is a service. It's something of value, right? So Apple should get compensation for that. And that's part of what the 30% cut goes to cover. And so some people might want to have all their purchase relationships be through Apple. And it also, I think, is convenient, right? It simplifies your billing. It simplifies your subscription management. You have all your subscriptions in one place. And Apple makes that pretty easy to manage. And Jill says that she, and I imagine many others, would actually be willing to pay more to keep that relationship with Apple. So it might not have to be an all or nothing thing, right? But yeah, Apple takes a 30% cut. Hey, for example, their yearly service is $100 a year. When you do an in-app purchase subscription and that auto renews, Apple takes a smaller cut. They take 15%. So if you do the math, you could, as say, hey, decide, well, on Apple, if you want to do an in-app purchase, rather than paying $100 a year, you pay $118 a year. So that's, you know, take Apple's 15% cut out and leave Hey with the $100 that they originally wanted, and you get to a price of $118. So they could still offer that subscription, have an in-app purchase, and those people who would be willing to pay a little bit more can do that. Those who don't want to pay a little bit more, hey, you can go to the website and subscribe there for $100 a year and save a little bit of money. And that way, everybody has the option and you're not cutting out a portion of your market. And I can totally see that point. That makes a lot of sense to me. Now, the main downside may be that some customers don't know that they can actually not have to do the in-app purchase, and that they could get a lower direct rate through the website. And that could potentially pose a customer service issue, right? Especially if you have something that's a lot more expensive. Imagine if you wanted to recoup that 30% cut, you do the math there, they'd have to charge about $143 a year for the Apple in-app purchase and only $100 on their website. So if you paid $143 and then found out you could have paid only $100, you might be a little bit miffed, right? So it's a weird, odd thing. And I think that's the crux of my dilemma with this. Because I get the point on both sides, right? I would love to do everything through my Apple account and through in-app purchases. I think it's super convenient. I love the privacy and security that it offers. But at the same time, I want to support developers. I want developers to be able to make enough money to make it worthwhile and not have to charge, you know, crazy prices and things like that. And Apple taking as large a cut as they do, it's come up time and time again. You know, I don't think I'm just making this up. Many developers have brought this up as a point of heartache with the App Store. And I think it may be time that Apple adjusts those rates down a bit. I think they can. I don't know that they will. But again, that's just my opinion. I'm opening this up for conversation here in our community. Let us know what you think. Maccast@gmail.com. Now, I know this guy doesn't need defending from me, but I got a little bit kind of upset, I guess, is the best way to put it, this week when I read a story about Tom Hanks. Now, we've talked about his new movie, Greyhound. It is coming exclusively to Apple TV Plus on July 10th. So maybe even by the time you're hearing this, it's out on Apple TV Plus. This was a film. It was supposed to go into theaters. It was being produced by Sony Pictures. With everything that was going on, Sony decided, we're not going to release it to theaters. We're going to sell it to somebody. They put it out to bidding. Apple paid, I believe, $70 million for the exclusive rights to the film, and they're going to be releasing it. And so because it was getting ready to come out, Tom Hanks was out doing press junkets, right? He was talking to press remotely from his house, and he made a couple of remarks in an interview with The Guardian, and Apple fans and the Apple world lost its freaking mind, in my opinion. Speaking to The Guardian, he said when he was asked about it coming to Apple TV Plus, that it's, quote, an absolute heartbreak. I don't mean to make angry my Apple overlords, but there's a difference in picture and sound quality. He later also mentioned in the interview that the, quote, cruel whipmasters at Apple made him do the remote interview from his home with kind of a plain backdrop. They didn't want anything complex behind him, just a wall. And he complied, but also said, here I am, bowing to the needs of Apple TV. And so with those little snippets and tidbits, the internet lost its freaking mind. They went nuts. A lot of people angry at Tom Hanks and defending Apple and saying he should feel lucky and privileged to have his film coming out on Apple TV Plus. And you know, I saw this as basically two things. You know, I think there was definitely an overreaction from the Apple community. If you listen to Tom Hanks, or if you're a fan of Tom Hanks, you know he has kind of this wry, sometimes snarky sense of humor. And I think that's what was going on in this interview. I think he was kind of playing along and maybe doesn't always come across very well in print. I don't think he was upset or angry or ungrateful for what Apple was doing. And keep in mind, right, his relationship was really with Sony. So it was Sony who sold this off. And Apple just happened to buy it. But so I think that was going on there. But also, I think it was an honest assessment of how anyone would feel if you worked on a passion project. This was something, he's the writer, producer, starring in it. Like, he worked on this thing for 10 years, almost 10 years, and was probably planning on it being a big summer blockbuster release and going into theaters. And then, you know, COVID happened and all stuff got weird. And now it's going straight to a streaming service. It's kind of like going direct to video in some ways. I mean, better, obviously, but obviously not probably what he wanted. And so I could understand a bit of frustration and, you know, kind of playing that out. You know, he did it in the media, and I guess that's ultimately what people got ticked off about. But later in a Today Show interview, he did make some more gracious comments about the relationship with Apple and Apple TV's Plus and the release of the film, saying that he's, quote, thrilled the movie will be debuted on the service, and also that, quote, we feel as though we were rescued at sea by a convoy with a big Apple logo with a bite taken out of it. So he made nice. Question is, how much of that was Hanks versus Apple's PR and the puppet masters there trying to make him do damage control? And I'm only half kidding there. As someone who has dealt directly with Apple PR and been on the other side of it, those guys, you know, they basically want you to do what they want you to do, and it's not always that fun. I, a few years back, did an event in San Francisco at an Apple store. We were supposed to have a certain kind of event. It was all set up and ready to go. And honestly, at the last minute, the last hour, Apple PR jumped in and we had to completely rejigger and change everything. Otherwise, they were basically going to kick us out of the store and not let us do our thing. So, you know, they have ways of pulling your strings and making you do what they want. And so Hanks also may have been reacting to that a little bit. Now, I have to tell you, this is probably not going to help my situation with Apple either by mentioning this. But, you know, it's been years since that happened, and I know the PR team's different now, and maybe it's not that way anymore. But they have their way of doing things, and it's real, and people feel it. So I can understand where maybe Tom Hanks was coming from. Again, I think he was being a little bit cheeky and wry, and a lot of people made way more out of it than they really needed to. But looking forward to the film, Greyhound. I will watch it and maybe share my opinions on the next episode of the MacCast. It looks good. What do you think about the idea of iOS apps reading your text and information and looking at your pictures? Yeah, it feels kind of creepy, doesn't it? Well, something happened this week with the release of iOS 14 and the betas. They have a new security feature built in called clipboard notifications. It's a new security feature, and basically what it does is it tells you now, with a little notification alert, when various apps paste the contents of your clipboard into the app so that they can actually read them. And this is something in iOS that apps have had the ability to do for a while now. And there are some reasons, legitimate reasons for it, like automation and data detection. So if you've ever had one of the apps where you open the app or you go to the app and it says, hey, I see that you have a URL on your clipboard. You know, maybe it's a podcast app and you've just copied from Safari a URL for the feed URL. And it can detect it and say, hey, I notice you got a URL in there. Do you want to subscribe to that URL? And it does it automatically. Well, that's all enabled by this feature where the app can actually read and look at what's on your clipboard. But what has happened with the release of clipboard notifications in iOS 14 is people are discovering a lot of apps are reading the contents of your clipboard a lot of the time, and it's not entirely clear what they're doing with that information. So a not so legitimate, you know, way of or use of this feature would be, hey, reading the text off your clipboard, scanning that, looking for keywords, and using that for ad networks and ad notifications and to build profiles on you. Yeah, scary, right? Because do you remember the last thing that you copied to your clipboard? Picture your kids, some private text from someone, maybe something at work. Yeah, the idea of apps, iOS apps, having full access to that data, not so great, right? And that's what this feature is all about. It's to let you know so you can kind of better keep control over your privacy. I don't know if there's a way to stop the apps from doing that, like to control, you know, telling it, hey, don't let this app read the contents of the clipboard. I would hope so. But at the very least, you could then either question the developer, and that's what's happening a lot right now, or just simply delete and not use that app anymore. And Apple does have some new APIs that can make it a little bit better and a little bit more secure. So a lot of developers coming out and saying, hey, you know, we just need to do this for reasons A, B, and C, and it kind of makes sense. A lot of them also coming out and saying, oh, we didn't even know our app was doing that. You know, mea culpa, it's a bug sort of thing. Take it or leave it, whether you believe them or not, right? It's a little bit questionable. But what Apple is doing is just trying to give us this transparency so that we know what's going on and can think a little bit more about it. And developers are going to be held a little bit more accountable because of that transparency. And that's ultimately a good thing. The other thing that Apple is doing, though, because I guess these messages, at least in the current iOS 14 beta, because it's happening so frequently, are actually annoying. They're popping up a lot in a lot of apps. And so what Apple is doing is actually giving developers a new API that allows the apps to, rather than just directly immediately reading the clipboard, it can actually ask the clipboard, hey, what kind of content do you have in there? Do you have a URL? Do you have some text? Is it a photo? And then the app can decide accordingly whether or not it needs to copy in, you know, or paste in and read that information. So if it's, again, the example of a podcast app that might be looking for podcast URLs, it could literally say, hey, do you have a URL that is an RSS or an XML URL? And if it reports back, nope, I don't have that, then they don't have to read the contents, right? Because they know it doesn't have the kind of data that they're looking for. If it reports back yes, then it can say, okay, go ahead and paste it in. I'm going to use it, you know. But if you had a photo on there or some other kind of URL, it could simply just ignore it, and then you wouldn't get the notification because it never actually read the contents of the clipboard. So hopefully apps will adapt and do a little bit better job of, you know, honoring our privacy. Of course, there's always going to be the ones that are just nefarious, and now we have the transparency to go in and tell those to bugger off, right? Get out of here. I don't want you. So I don't know. What do you think about this? Are you concerned about this? Is this something that you think is a good thing? Is it going to be ultimately super annoying? I know some of you are probably already on the betas, so maybe you've experienced this and you can share your experiences with us. Send us some feedback. You know the email address. Something else that has happened in the last couple of weeks, and like I said at the top of the show, I think this is because a lot of us are at home a little bit more. I know I've had a couple of you email in and say, hey, I'm working from home now. I need to kind of get my home network in a little bit better shape. I can't have things going down. It's a little bit more critical. A lot of people asking me questions about routers. And I think another thing that's going on here is many of us, being Apple fans, have had routers, Airport Expresses, Airport Extremes. Apple obviously discontinued the Airport a few years back, so those Airports a little bit long in the tooth. And so a lot of people thinking about, hey, new router, I want better coverage, I want newer technology. What do you think, Adam? What kind of things should I be buying? What should I be thinking about? What is a good replacement for my Airport Extreme? And I'll be honest with you up front. This is not a area that I am at all an expert in. You know, I have an Airport Extreme. That's what I've been using mostly. I also have an older Eero system. This was when they were a sponsor before they were purchased by Amazon. Both great systems, and they serve me very, very well. But I too have been thinking about routers, and maybe upgrading, because, you know, mine are quite a few years old and there are a lot of choices out there now, a lot of options, and I can totally see how it can be confusing. I'm confused. You know, I'm not an expert and I'm super confused, but I'll share with you how I'm thinking about it because a lot of you are asking me. And the way I think about it is, for me, from a non-technical standpoint, and I'm not going to get into a lot of the nitty-gritty. I'm not going to get into the numbers. If you want some of that, a great place to go is Mac Geek Gab over at the Mac Observer. Dave Hamilton gets into this stuff like deep in the weeds. If you want an opinion on this stuff, maybe we'll even have him on the show, because he tests the heck out of this stuff, and he's the guy I go to for information. But at a real general level, just in terms of thinking about, you know, what should I buy? What should I be looking at? What are the things I should be considering when I'm, you know, reading articles and reading reviews and looking at things, is, in my opinion, it comes down to coverage as well as, of course, speed. And I think these days, you know, how many devices are you going to need to support, especially with Internet of Things and HomeKit and home automation? We've got a lot more devices on our network, and different routers kind of have support for different numbers of devices. And they're starting to kind of list those numbers in the specs. So my first bit of advice is, if you can avoid wireless altogether, that's a great way to go. Wired, always better than wireless. So if you can get a wire to a device, do it. Probably really not realistic in this day and age for most things, but anything that you can wire up, think about it. And it's something to consider when you're buying a wireless router, because a lot of them have built-in hubs, have built-in network ports for hardwiring things. So if you have a number of devices that you want to hardwire, maybe you want more ports built into your router. You, of course, can also get, you know, switches and other things to expand that, but maybe you want a few more built-in. So that might be factoring into your buying decision. I think another huge thing these days is to mesh or not to mesh. And if you don't know what mesh is, I'll try to, again, break it down at a pretty high level. If you have an existing router, like an Airport Extreme, you basically have one point of access for all your devices on your wireless network, right? That thing is connected to your cable modem. That is your wireless access point. It's somewhere centrally in your house, probably. And every device that needs a wireless connection connects to it. And they're all kind of treated, you know, equally within that network. A mesh system sets up zones of coverage that sort of talk to each other. So they kind of backlink and they link up to each other and create a grid. So you usually have, with a mesh network, more than one device. You'll have two or three or four. It just depends on how much coverage you need and how many devices. And so it's a great way, especially if you have dead zones, to kind of cover all your bases. And another great thing about it is that your devices are going to connect to the closest kind of mesh node. And so you're going to have different devices on different access points. They're not all going to be saturating that one access point, and then they're all interconnected. So you kind of create this mesh of coverage across your house. And so it can be a great choice if you have a lot of area to cover. And we're talking about thousands of square feet, you know, like 2,500 to 5,000 square feet or more for mesh systems. Of course, you can use a mesh system in a smaller area, especially, again, if you have, you know, walls or a setup where you just have dead zones, even a small space, which can happen. You can use mesh to kind of put different access points within line of sight and get around corners and get around dead zones and stuff like that. So that's another great choice or a reason to go with a mesh system. But newer routers have better technologies and better coverage these days too. So a lot of the base station routers are going to be able to cover areas like, you know, 2,000, 2,500 square feet. When you start getting bigger than that, you really might want to consider looking at mesh. And a mesh can also, as you might imagine, because it sets up multiple zones and access points, can help you if you have a lot of devices that need to connect, and especially if you have those devices grouped in certain areas, right? You can put a mesh spot in that area and get coverage to that area for those devices. So it's a good way to go to kind of distribute out your network. And a lot of newer routers, just to, you know, sort of complicate things even a little bit more, also work as mesh systems. So what's cool about this is you might want to shop for a new router for a centralized area of your house, and then try that out, see how it works. And then if you still wind up with some areas of weak coverage or dead coverage, if you buy a router that supports mesh, you can get another satellite mesh unit and then add that onto your network later. So you don't have to make that big investment up front. And cost is definitely a thing here. You know, you can get some pretty expensive routers, but in general, as I've been looking at things, a router is a little less expensive than buying a, say, 2 or 3 node mesh system right off the bat. And so that might be worth something, or something worth considering, right? Can I get a router that is going to allow me to grow into a mesh network if that's something that I need? But I would say when you're out shopping, some things to look at in terms of specs and recommendations are, or things to think about, I guess is a better way to put this, is, you know, what is the area that you have to cover? How much square footage do I have? And do I have kind of dead zones in that square footage? And then when you're looking at the specs of a router or a mesh system, match that up to your square footage. Make sure it's going to give you all of the coverage that you need. Number of devices you need to support. Again, look at the numbers, look at the specs for the system that you're looking at, and make sure that it can support the number of devices. And something I've noticed that's even more important now, I think, is maximum network speeds, because there's a lot of mesh systems out on the market, and now not all mesh systems are created equal. There's a whole range of maximum speeds, and it generally follows that the cheaper mesh systems kind of max out in terms of their maximum throughput. So look at your level of internet service, you know, what is the bandwidth coming into your house, and make sure that you match that up or get a system that will get within range of supporting that. So if you have gigabit internet coming into your house, but you pick a mesh system or a router that maxes out at 300 megabits per second, that might be a big deal to you, right? Because it means, great, you've got gigabit coming into your house, but your devices can't even get up to that speed to support it. So you're going to want to look at something that is more maybe in the 600 or 800, 900 megabits per second range. I don't know if they have gigabit wireless mesh systems yet. I maybe they do. I haven't seen it. You know, Wi-Fi 6, 802.11ax, those are new technologies that are out on the market. They're just coming to fruition. I think only the iPhone 11 Pros now currently support Wi-Fi 6, so Apple doesn't have a lot of Wi-Fi 6 devices out there yet, but we're moving in that direction. So do you need Wi-Fi, new Wi-Fi right now? Do you need new Wi-Fi 6 technologies or 802.11ax technologies? Maybe, maybe not. Obviously good for future-proofing, but if you don't need new Wi-Fi right now, maybe you want to wait. Because the longer you wait, the better deal you get on new technology, and you can wait until it's something you can actually use. You know, maybe get a Wi-Fi 6 Mac and then update your Wi-Fi to Wi-Fi 6, and that way you don't have to pay that higher price, because you're going to pay more for being an early adopter of that technology. So these are all things to look at and consider. And I guess, you know, getting down to the nitty-gritty of it, probably the last question most people ask me is, what exactly should I buy? You know, Adam, tell me what I should buy, because I really don't know. And the answer is, I can't really answer that question for you, because your needs will not match someone else's. So I'd really need to know those specifics. The things we talked about is, you know, what kind of area are you covering? How many devices do you have? Do you have dead zones? What's the layout of your house? What's the maximum speed of your network? What's your inbound internet? You know, look at all these things and just try to match the specs up. And then I guess the other thing that I get asked about a lot is brand. And fortunately, right now, there's a lot of great options at a lot of great different price points. So brands that I think are great, Netgear, Eero, Synology, Google, TP-Link, D-Link. There's many others, but those are kind of the big ones. And there's a whole range of prices and that sort of stuff. If you ask me personally what I've been looking at, the systems I've been considering and looking at are the Synology solution, Eero, which I think has one of the best and easiest setup experiences. But again, they were bought recently by Amazon, so take that with the, you know, for what it's worth. Some people, that's bothersome to them. Same thing with Google. They have some great solutions. But I've been looking at Synology, the Synology solution, the Netgear solution, and the Eero solution, both in terms of mesh and just standard routers. I have a pretty small place, 1,600 square foot. I don't have very many dead zones. So probably just a Synology router would be what I would be looking at. The Nighthawk routers from Netgear are really nice, but really expensive, and that's probably more than I want to spend. So budget is also, I guess, a consideration when you're thinking about this. You know, how much do you have to spend? How much do you want to spend? And consider that. And maybe hold off and wait on the newer technologies till prices come down and see if you can't get by with what you're looking at. But those are some of my thoughts and recommendations on routers and router purchasing and mesh and all that sort of stuff. If you have more or additional questions, of course, you can email me, mattcast@gmail.com, and I will try to answer all of your questions. And if you have recommendations, or if you've recently upgraded your network and have information you want to share with the community, also send that along. Audio comments would be greatly welcomed, and maybe we can get some other opinions and other voices in on this topic. All right, a couple more things to wrap up with. I know we're running a little bit long, but we haven't been around the last couple of weeks, so maybe we're going to make up for it a little bit here. I do want to talk about something that came up from a listener, a question about accessing radio, and I'm talking about old school terrestrial radio inside Apple Music. I know some of you probably know about Beats One in Apple Music, which is Apple's, you know, online radio service. Pretty neat stuff. They've got some great stations and content in there. But what we're really talking about here is iTunes back in the day had this section, which was a collection of broadcast radio stations. And after Apple broke up iTunes in macOS into separate applications, it wasn't clear where radio stations went. And Brian wrote in to ask me about this. And the reality is, they are still in Apple Music, but they are different. Apple has not really provided, I think, the clearest way to figure out where radio stations are or how to access them. We don't just have that radio tab and then it was like sorted by category and you can kind of could kind of browse down and find the radio station that you were looking for. What they've done now is they've changed and they're partnering with services and apps like iHeartRadio and TuneIn. You don't need a separate app installed in your Mac. It's built into Apple Music into Apple Music and the music app. But what you're looking for is over in the sidebar, you'll see radio under the Apple Music section. And then if you scroll down within the radio section, because that's where like Beats One and a few other things are, there is a broadcast radio section. And there's a little show all button you can click in there. But I noticed in my music app, there was only about half a dozen, maybe a dozen stations listed. So the real way to find broadcast radio stations in Apple Music is literally to use search and to search for the call letters of the station that you're looking for. That's the way I've been able to find the most stations. And you'll find most of them just pop up. They're in there. Apple has been adding a lot of them, again, through these different services. And another cool way you can ask for them or find them is simply ask Siri or ask your HomePod or Apple TV to play them as well. So you can just say, hey, play radio station, and then the name of the station, or even better yet, the call letters of the station. The name of the station, sometimes you'll end up with like an Apple Music radio station if you're an Apple Music subscriber, which is like a, you know, they call them stations, but basically they just make a custom playlist, you know, surrounding the kind of thing that you were asking for. So just ask for the call letters of your station. So, you know, play 91X or whatever it might be. And I think you'll frankly be surprised, or just search for that inside the music app. So that's how you access radio inside Apple Music. All right, the last thing that I have for you, and this is sort of timely, is backup when you're back at school. Justin wrote in, his daughter is and her Mac are going to be leaving the safety of his home network and moving off to college pretty soon. And while in the house, that Mac and the house rules have an insistence on good backup. So Super Duper, Time Machine, all the things that we talk about here on the MacCast are being done. But once that Mac leaves the safety and confines and control of Justin, he's a little bit worried what his daughter's going to do. You know, is she going to plug in the USB drive that he sends along every day so that, you know, Super Duper and Time Machine can run? He's not convinced that that will happen. And so he asked me, you know, what are your recommendations? Like, how can I make sure that her machine is getting backed up when she's at school, even if she doesn't remember to kind of do those things? And my immediate reaction was, well, Justin, obviously you're a good father, right? You have set up good habits at home, and that's where it all starts. And it sounds like you raised your daughter right to know the value of good backup, and I think she might surprise you. She might do better than you think. I think she knows you have instilled in her the knowledge of good backup, and she'll take that to heart. But hey, let's say she doesn't. Let's say she never plugs that thing in. The question is, you know, what would I recommend? And one thing you said in your email was perhaps it's not as important since Macs don't have spinning drives anymore, which were previously the weak link. Nope. Let's not go down that route. Backup is needed regardless of the type of drive. Disasters happen. Things happen. Spills happen. Drives still fail, even SSDs. So no, solid state does not preclude us from backup. And I know you know this already, but I just need to remind the audience and everybody. So Justin did have a couple questions. He said, do non-Apple devices like Western Digital's MyCloud Home work with Time Machine? And the answer is yes. Actually, a lot of network-attached storage solutions these days support Time Machine. So you can look for that. I have a Synology, and it supports Time Machine, and that's actually how I get my kids' machines backed up, because they never plug them into anything. I can't get them to even do that at home. So kudos on you for getting your daughter to do that at home. But the issue with a network-attached storage drive is obviously it needs to be on the same network as the Mac, and I'm not up to date with how colleges are, but my suspicion is that they're not going to let you connect a NAS device to their network. So I don't know that would really be a solution. Again, I think you'd still have to directly plug that in to be able to access it, because I don't think they're going to let those on their network. So then the follow-up question was, well, then what about remote backup? You know, is that good enough? How do you recover from that? And I would say, yeah, that's a great option. I like to have a multi-tier backup solution, as you know, so I don't like to rely on any one thing. But I do think that a network solution, you know, like cloud backup, is probably the best option if you don't think that she'll keep up with, you know, plugging in and backing up locally. And that's because, you know, colleges, they're on great networks in general. They have a lot of bandwidth. You can access the internet, and something like Backblaze would automatically back up over the internet and offers cool advanced features like versioning of your documents. Obviously, as you pointed out, recovery, not quite as simple, but it's not too bad. You can actually go into their user interface. You can grab individual files. If you had to do a full restore of the Mac, you'd have to basically download an entire copy of the backup as a zip, open that up, and then you'd be, you know, more or less manually recovering that. It's not as simple as a Super Duper clone where you can boot up off that clone and reinstall the operating system and do all that stuff, or even a Time Machine backup where you can just simply reinstall the operating system and recover from Time Machine. Recovery is not going to be that simple, but at least you still have a recovery option. You still have a backup. So, and I do think that's probably the easiest. You don't have to remember. It's always running in the background as long as you're connected to a network, which at college, you're probably going to be always connected to a network. You're good. You're golden. So I think that is a great option. The last thing that Justin asked about was iCloud Drive. You know, she has iCloud. iCloud Drive, is that adequate enough? If you set up all of the iCloud options, set up the Mac to sync the documents and the desktop, which is where most of the files are probably going to be, set up iCloud Drive for, or iCloud Photo Library for photo backups. Yeah, is that enough? Will that work? It definitely will work. I would say, you know, make sure she doesn't use the optimize storage option, which, you know, when your Mac's hard drive starts to get full, then keeps a copy only in iCloud. I don't like the idea of having all my eggs in one basket, so to speak, or all my files or documents in one place. To me, that's not really backup. So you're putting a lot of trust in Apple at that point. And as much as I love Apple, I'm not going to trust them with my data. You know, they, if you read the terms of service, I can guarantee you they're not guaranteeing you that they're going to always have copies of that stuff. You know, that said, I think they do a great job and I'm sure they have distributed multiple backups. The thought that you're going to lose anything in iCloud, I think is pretty remote. But hey, things happen and that's why we have backups, right? That's why we have local backups. So could be an option. I think doing the iCloud Drive stuff coupled with a good online backup solution is going to be your best bet. Well, really the best bet is encouraging her to attach her Mac to a USB hub that has external drives on it that are set up with, you know, automated backups along with backup in the cloud. I think that's the best thing, doing both. But barring that, some sort of combination of iCloud and cloud storage, probably the way to go. But I don't really know. Maybe I'm just out of touch or out of date with what's going on college campuses, and some of you out there know and have some additional recommendations or maybe something to even counter, maybe a bad recommendation I just gave out. I don't know. But let me know your thoughts and opinions. Shoot me some feedback, maccast@gmail.com. But with that, that is going to do it for this episode of the MacCast. Very glad to be back here with you. As always, like to take a moment and thank some of my supporters, Smile, makers of Text Expander and PDF Pen, both for Mac and for iOS. You can get more information and details on all of their great software by visiting smilesoftware.com/podcast. Bandwidth for the MacCast is provided by CacheFly. You can find them at cachefly.com. And all advertising on the MacCast is handled by Backbeat Media. You can find them at backbeatmedia.com. As always, I love hearing from you. If you have a comment, a question, something you'd like to hear covered on a future episode of the MacCast, you can send your emails and audio comments to maccast@gmail.com. You can also call in on the listener hotline and leave a voicemail. That phone number, 281-622-4269, 281-MAC-IAM-9. If you need show notes, links to anything that I talked about on this or any other episode of the MacCast, you'll find those on the website. That's at maccast.com. And you can find me on social media, Twitter, twitter.com/MacCast, Facebook, facebook.com/TheMacCast, and Instagram, the Mac, or just MacCast, just MacCast on Instagram. Hope to see you there. But until next time, I will talk to you all again real soon.